Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. Thank you for being with us today. RedIce.tv is the website. We are a media outlet that gives you a pro-European perspective. We advocate for European identity, self-preservation, and self-determination of European people and nations wherever they are. Please check on the site frequently for more radio shows, videos, our live TV show, of course, news, and more. And by the way, you can hear us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud. And if you do one thing, definitely make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube channel and enable the alerts. We do live shows. We upload videos frequently and radio shows that goes up on our channel as well. So you definitely don't want to miss any of that. Well, today we have Daniel Friedberg back on the show from Arctos and Right On. He's the author of The Real Right Returns and a very active in the identitarian scene in Europe. Welcome back, Friedberg. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you for having me once again. And I'm happy to be back.
As always, it was over a year ago since you were on. Well, actually, it was in January. We did a kind of a roundtable, I guess. But before that, it was over a year ago since we, spoke on the show. And actually, we have had a tremendous amount of developments in our favor in the last, I'd say, 6 to 8 months. Of course, we had Trump's victory. Very interesting. We've had exposure of the alt-right that has been getting more and more pretty interesting coverage, actually. We, of course, had Brexit. We had a no result, thankfully, in Italy's referendum, leading to the resignation of Renzi. Unfortunately, it wasn't as good for Hofer in Austria, but, that's actually one of the downsides, unfortunately. We can talk more about that later. But one of the central tenets why we have you here today as well, Daniel, is because we have an upcoming event we want to discuss here a little bit later in the first segment. In Stockholm, Identitarian Ideas at the end of February. So we're going to get more into that. But these are, just some of the things that I wanted to get your take on and kind of get your point and see how these things, reflect overall. Because, Trump's victory is an interesting one. Let's begin with that first and see what your take on that is. And if you think, I guess, from a European perspective, from a European nationalist perspective, what do you think Trump is going to, what kind of effect is that going to have on European politics?
Well, it's going to have a tremendous effect for several reasons. I mean, first of all, the US is the world's only superpower. So in if you talk about realpolitik, it's going to have a tremendous effect. But we shouldn't forget the metapolitical effect as well. I mean, considering the fact that the U.S. has been the cultural center of the world, basically, since the end of the Second World War, what happens in the U.S. always have quite significant repercussions all over the rest of the world. And the Trump victory is obviously going to provide the international real right or alt-right or whatever you want to call it, a lot of legitimacy. And it's going to shift the power balance, and it's going to shift the perception the regular people have of our ideas and our movement. And I was one of the earliest people that actually predicted his victory. I mean, even as early as shortly after he announced his candidacy, I was telling people from the U.S. that this guy is going to be your next president. I mean, I it was enough for me to see his first speech and see the other candidates to kind of realize that. And also the overarching trends, I mean, that is definitely in our favor. To speak with Avolian terms, I think Trump is very much a man in time, instead of a man against time, like some other big historical figures, because he's tapping into the overall trends, which is a paradigm shift, an ongoing paradigm shift to the right, a rise of nationalism and right-wing politics overall. I mean, real right-wing politics, not the liberal fake right. And so it was not unexpected at all for me that he won, but I'm still very, very happy about it because it kind of opens up a new chapter, a new era, and Brexit also ties into this. It's also a sign of the times, and I'm quite certain that we are going to see many, many more of these events in the next year. We have the German national election. We have the Dutch national elections and so forth. And we're going to reap huge victories there as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's going to help to shift, the center of gravity, if you will, of the political discussion, very much so in our favor. Just a quick note on this. I mean, how much do you think that the alt-right, which is really, of course, it has a lends a lot of its ideological backbone from the European new right, but how much do you think that the alt-right influenced the election and managed to, some people take a lot of credit for it and says the alt-right like memed him into office. I'm not sure necessarily that's the whole truth here, but I think he carried some weight of kind of a countercurrent, a countercultural narrative that I think a lot of Americans like. They like the kind of the underdog phenomenon. Despite the fact that Trump is a billionaire, he was still kind of seen as an underdog in a way. But what do you think?
Absolutely, and I definitely think that the influence of the alt-right was significant. I mean, just compare the dedication of the hardcore Trump supporters, which pretty much all identify as alt-right to some extent, and all of their YouTube videos, homemade YouTube videos, which were quite professional. It was noticeable that people really put some effort and time into making all of these videos and all these memes, and I didn't see any of that on Hillary's side. The only thing I saw there when it comes to grassroots support was George Soros-funded revolutionary radical leftist movements like Black Lives Matter and so forth.
Page shields,
yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a fake grassroots movement financed by big money, while the alt-right is definitely something organic that has no such financial support whatsoever. I mean, this is something real, something really coming from the depth of the people's of the people, basically, of the depth of our soul, or how do you put it?
It's from a deeper desire, I think, to really actually have some change and ignore all the political. I think, to a certain extent, I also think that two terms of Obama also paved it couldn't be a more perfect way for Trump, in all honesty. Obama was all these things that people were hoping for, change, and truly now things are going to begin to transform. And I know that that's kind of from a left perspective, but I actually know a lot of people that have come over to the alt-right side that even in, not only in 2008, but 2012 also voted for Obama. And so that, that myth of him as being this great, some kind of messiah or something, that's been shattered completely. And I think they were very, very ready for someone like Trump,
I'm not surprised. I mean, we can see the same trends. I mean, apart from Arctis, we obviously have a lot of other projects going for us as well, like Rightom.net and our Swedish or Scandinavian think tank Motpool.nu. What we see in the immense rise of support, I mean, previous years, I don't care, or actually this year's edition of our annual conference, Identitarian Ideas, resulted in a twice the amount of participants compared to previous years, and we saw a whole new segments of people that we never saw before at our conferences. I mean, more than half of the attendants were totally new people who were there for the first time, and I would say that probably the majority of these new people were disenfranchised libertarians that had been red-pilled over the past few years after the disappointment with the Ron Paul campaign and so forth, but also some former leftists that are totally fed up with the new modern regressive lefts with their trigger warnings on their safe spaces and all this ridiculous nonsense that they're engaging in. I think we're recruiting from both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah, we can talk a little bit later about the success and why that is, and the appeal of the ideas, and you know, what we can do to reach out more, etc. But what do you think, though, if we just zoom out a little bit more in terms of Russian relations now with Trump in office, the situation in Syria, which of course have been the incentive behind the migrant invasion into Europe. Trump is, of course, addressing immigration in a way that no politician really have before, which is bringing all of these ideas right at the forefront of people's consciousness, which is of course, you know, good. But it's there's quite a bit there. But some things have been very, these have been constants in American politics of like at least the last, you know, 2 years or so, a very anti-Russian stance. It has been very unresolved in how to solve the situation in Syria, in some cases even enabling, of course, ISIS through their stupid policies. Perhaps it is planned. But what do you think is going to happen with some of these more kind of geopolitical situations with Trump? Is that going to change, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, even if he only delivers on half of his promises, and some of those promises has been repeated so much that he can't really back away from those and not deliver on those. For example, repairing relations with Russia, which is a great thing. I mean, and it will have a tremendous effect on the EU as well. The EU is basically a lapdog of the US, and so far the EU has been the lapdog of the globalists, and now suddenly we are entering the era of Trump, which kind of leaves the EU disoriented. They don't really know what to do because all the sanctions against Russia is not really in Europe's interest. We are losing lots and lots of money from these sanctions and the inability to do proper trade with Russia when it comes to energy, for example. They're a major major exporter of energy in terms of natural gas and so forth to many European countries, and without the pressure from the globalists in Washington, which I assume will disappear with Trump in office, it opens up a very interesting situation, especially since most of Central and Eastern Europe are, well, have a pretty different stance when it comes to Russia, with some exceptions, of course. I mean, due to historical reasons, and they have some historical issues with Russia.
But grudges, for sure. Yeah.
with a good reason, you might say. But I mean, you have to realize that Putin's Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's actually something entirely different.
Yeah, despite what the New York Times says. But yeah, I get your point.
And I mean, the liberals, the leftist liberals in Europe are now caught between two major powers that have been branded in liberal media. I mean, two strong political figures, two strong political leaders, I mean, Trump and Putin, that have been branded in the European media, as well as the liberal Western media overall, as being kind of fascist dictators and right-wing extremists and homophobic sexist, yeah, whatever. I mean, you know, the typical bad words they like to call political leaders they don't like. Now they're kind of caught between two quite strong powers that are led by very, very clear right-wing governments, and even though the liberal media has exaggerated quite a lot when it comes to the potential fascism of Putin and Trump, it's still kind of fun to watch how they try to realign themselves and. Some of them are kind of accepting the new situation and kind of realigning themselves, like the Daily Beast, for example, that published a quite fair article, neutral, unbiased article about the alt-right and the roots of the alt-right, the ideological roots, where we got quite a lot of exposure. I mean, Arctus and European New Right. But while some other medias, especially in Sweden, of course, like Dagens Nyheter, the worst of the worst in terms of leftist liberal agenda journalism goes into a full frenzy and goes even further, which is it provides some entertainment value, I think, but I don't think they're very successful with their crazy propaganda.
No, and I think you know, it's good that they take this position, because you know, the amount of lies that they've pushed in the media, the amount of just nonsense and garbage, and people are waking up to the fact that this is, much of it is just conjecture and propaganda, and their opinions doesn't reflect reality. The more they put themselves in opposition to something like the alt-right, I sincerely believe, I mean, yes, of course, after MPI and that kind of controversy, there's of course a lot of people who are, you know, maybe angered, and they swallow the media's portrayal of all of this, of course. But the media has done enough stupid things to put themselves in an interesting situation where if they paint out an enemy, I think a lot of people are going to give that so-called enemy more time, maybe, than they would have done in the past. In other words, I think it will be appealing to a lot of people, and they will at least take a little bit of time and look at it objectively and see, why does the establishment, why does the media hate these ideas so much? What is it that they're so afraid of? And I think that there's a benefit to us in that equation.
Absolutely. I can see two major benefits. First of all, it puts us in the spotlight, gives us a lot of media attention, which we can already notice, for example, in the latest article in the Daily Beast, and an increased interest overall. We have journalists contacting us every week, wanting to do interviews and so forth about Arctus and our influence on the alt-right, and so forth. And secondly, people are not that fond of the leftist liberal media, because, I mean, just the fact that Trump won the election is kind of a clear indication that people does not really trust the media that much, the mainstream media. That is, if they did, they wouldn't have voted for Trump. So what we can see here is a legitimacy crisis for liberalism in general, and leftist liberal media in particular, all over the Western world. And whoever they paint out to be the scary enemy is likely to become the object of some level of curiosity and even positive feelings among the general population, because they hate the liberal media so much, and they distrust them so much. So if they portray us as the enemy, it will only be good for us.
Yeah, that is definitely true. Now, there's been a kind of an overhaul too of some of the stances on some of these countries, that either relations have deteriorated with the U.S. or they have not even spoken with them in a while. For example, Duterte in the Philippines, kind of an interesting guy, an interesting leader. The way he's gone after, you know, the drug dealers in the Philippines, it's of course neighboring very closely to the Golden Triangle, where so much, you know, heroin is produced. But there seems to be a willingness on the part of Trump of actually, you know, talking with him. I don't know, can't remember if he invited him to the White House, but it was a very diplomatic call. Same thing to Taiwan's president. I think he's invited Orban to the White House. He's of course been on very good terms with UKIP's Nigel Farage and stuff like that. So things are shifting, and there's a lot of people, although some of these of course are not on board in all of our ideas, etc., but it shows a change from this kind of globalist kind of new world order type attitude to more independent, you know, pro-national sovereignty type of leaders that want to go their own direction and fight against globalism.
Absolutely, and that is a very positive sign when it comes to Trump. I mean, considering the kind of people that he have some extent at least allied himself with, or at least begun some sort of positive dialogue with, for example, Duterte in the Philippines, which is, I mean, he's called the Donald Trump of Asia for good reason. I mean, he's like Well, he has some similarities. I guess if Donald Trump was born in the Philippines, he would be somewhat like Duterte, even though Duterte is going a little bit further than Donald Trump. I mean, he called Obama son of a whore, and I think he called the U.S. ambassador a faggot or something.
Right.
And but he has shown nothing but respect for Trump, for example, and praised the fact that he won. And this is a pretty hardcore guy. I mean, he's executed hundreds of thousands of drug dealers in the short period since he took office, and also started a war against the Islamist militias in the Philippines, which he will probably win quite easily, considering the fact that he is the president and has control over their military and so forth. I mean, of course, Nigel Farage, which is a very popular, increasingly popular political figure in European politics, and especially after Brexit. And an excellent speaker, and the fact that the kind of signal that it sends out when Trump invites him to the Republican National Congress, for example, to speak and so forth, and engage in friendly relationships with this person who is demonized in Britain for being kind of xenophobic and so forth, pretty much in the same way that Trump has been by the liberal media in the US. And it would be nice to see what kind of effect this might have on the French presidential election and so forth, because there is definitely something to the phenomenon of the Trump effect, and I definitely believe that the fact that Trump is in office will be very helpful to the presidential campaign from Marine Le Pen, and she came pretty close last time, and I think next year she has a real chance of winning, very much thanks to Trump.
Yeah, and it's about time too. I mean, Paris and the state of France, and actually let's spend a little bit of time on that before we talk more about the Identitarian Ideas Conference in Stockholm here in February next year. But we have seen a tremendous development in France. I remember just about a month ago, a little bit more, we had these new migrant jungles popping out, I think it was around the metro station in Paris. And it's been such a, just amazing development in France. I can't believe some of the footage that I'm seeing. And France, of course, has been ideologically or many of the ideas have, as we mentioned, have come out of many French, thinker like Guillaume Fay and Alain de Benoist and these kinds of people. If we just for a moment talk about that a little bit and how it relates to also to the conference or that movement. I guess the identitarian movement is kind of like, that's kind of like the alt-right, but in Europe, it, to a certain extent, I'd say. How would you describe that to a newcomer? Let's assume we have a new person with us who just is completely green on all this and don't really know what's going on, but they're interested and appealed. There is an appeal to these kinds of ideas. How would you explain identitarianism and what that is on the European scene?
Well, I think you described it pretty well when referring to them as the European version of the alt-right, even though I would say viewing the alternative right in a broader sense, you could argue that even more groups should be included when it comes to Europe, because Europe is different from the US. We have lots of different successful nationalist movements that are very much inspired by the new right, for example, and that are very closely aligned with the ideas of the alternative right in the US. And even looking at the international alternative right, people often make the mistake of thinking that all the memes and all the YouTube videos online are created by American representatives of the alternative right.
Right.
While that is actually not true. I mean, we have lots of Swedish people creating these kind of videos and memes, and we have lots of Germans and French people also very, very much engaged in this kind of internet metapolitical warfare and identifying themselves as part of the alt-right. So it is truly an international movement or phenomenon. And to get back to your question, I mean, even the foremost representatives of the American alt-right, like Richard Spencer, for example, identify himself as an identitarian, and many others as well. And to define the concept itself, it's pretty much affirming your own ethnic and cultural identity and wanting to preserve it, and realizing that we have a unique ethnic and cultural identity, and that it's worth defending against all the various ethnical and cultural and political threats that we are facing at the moment.
How would you say that, you know, some of the conferences that you guys are arranging here or putting on, that they will kind of influence things, and what direction would you like to see this go? I mean, I expect, of course, that there seems to be an upward growth. There's more people that want to come every year. And where do you think it should go from here? What's the next step in this growth process that we've seen in the last year?
Well, obviously, it's we are pretty much exclusively engaged in metapolitical activities, which means book publishing, running websites, publishing articles, organizing conferences. Pretty much winning the hearts and minds of the people, and winning more and more of the more intelligent people over to our side, which are the most important ones. I mean, of course, all supporters are important, but some are a little bit more important than others because they are more capable of influencing the people around them. And given the kind of intellectual profile of our projects, Arctus in particular, I would like to see, and I'm already seeing, an immense increase in interest and sales of our books. We've pretty much doubled our book sales over the past few months, and which means that more and more people are reading our books, and it's not. And that these people that actually make the effort of reading a 300 or 400 ideological work about the alternative right or identitarianism is obviously a very capable person intellectually, who will be able to play some sort of, hopefully, in the best case scenario at least, play some sort of leading role in the future and influence his surroundings and write articles and so forth. It's like a trickle down effect, to use economical terms. I think Trump used those as well. But an intellectual trickle down effect, where we kind of publish the core ideological works, providing a good ideological foundation for the intellectuals of our movement, which results in them writing more simple, easily to understand articles for a broader audience, which in turn results in a large readership that are influencing their friends and family and so forth by getting some intellectual ammunition that they can use. So yeah, that's basically what I'm seeing.
Very good. Well, tell us a bit about the upcoming identitarian ideas, what you guys have planned, and when and where, etc. And let's just talk a bit about that.
Absolutely. It's the ninth conference we organize in this conference series, which is kind of a lot. I mean, in our circles, it shows some dedication and continuity that we've actually been able to pull off nine annual conferences like this. And also the fact that the latest one gathered more than 250 attendants compared to between 120 and 130 all the previous years shows that something big is happening. And therefore, we decided that we would have another one, not in the autumn or like 1 year after the latest one, but actually much earlier, because we have momentum now, and we should use that momentum to our advantage, and therefore it's high time to organize another one and make sure to make it bigger and better in every way possible and more professional. And I mean, that is also why we invited Red Eyes TV to participate and report live from the event. Actually, you and Lana are going to speak as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, it's like I've always wanted to branch out more in the European events and everything else, and this is great. I mean, we need the European. I mean, we have a lot of developments that are positive and good, so I'm not saying that, but we need one of those major breaks as well. I see that obviously the Italian referendum is a good sign in this direction. Brexit is a good sign in this direction. Unfortunately, we didn't see these same results in Austria, but there's still time. There's an election coming up, and there's still good amount of energy behind these movements that are not going away anytime soon. But I hope we're seeing more of a kind of a clear break, if you will. And it's good to kind of symbolically show the effort and show the fact that there's buzz around these kinds of events. There's energy here. Things are happening. So it's a great initiative by you guys to continue to put these conferences on and making sure that it's grows. Tell us about some of the other speakers that you have coming up so far.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But before going into that, I want to stress the importance of, I mean, many people view the Trump victory as, yes, now we won, we can relax. I view it in the exact opposite way. I mean, yes, we are winning. We have the Trump victory, we have Brexit, we are making progress all over Europe. In every European country, anti-immigration parties or nationalist parties are making huge progress. But that is by no means an excuse to kind of relax and believe that things will kind of take care of themselves. On the contrary, it's a very good reason to kind of step up your game and increase your productivity and increase your work in every way imaginable. And that is also one of the major reasons we choose to organize this conference and make it the most ambitious one so far, especially in light of the successful MPI conference, which kind of tempted us a little bit to show that, well, we Europeans can also organize something like that, and we will try to make it better. We are happy if it's equally good, but our goal is, of course, to create something even better, and I think we have a good chance of accomplishing that. But when it comes to the speakers, we have a pretty extensive list of speakers so far. And before people get scared by the amount of speakers, I want to stress the fact that we have set a time limit of 15 minutes for each speaker. And I know for a fact that many of them will only speak for 5 to 10 minutes. So we will have a lot of room for socializing and for doing kind of interviews and panel discussions and whatnot during the breaks. And apart from you and Lana, we have Matthew Fournier, for example, who is a regular Write-On contributor and journalist. He's done a tremendous job covering the election and the primaries for Write-On. I can definitely recommend all of his articles on that subject on Write-On.net. We also have Ramsey Paul, which should be kind of familiar for a familiar figure for all of your listeners. And we also have Jason Reza Giorgiani, who's Arctus' newly appointed editor-in-chief and also author of the award-winning book Prometheus and Atlas that was published by Arctus, I think, in March this year. And apart from that, John Morgan, also from Arctus, director and co-founder, and also nowadays editor at Countercurrents, will give a speech, and me, myself, will also give a short speech, at least. And we have a bunch of pretty famous Scandinavian speakers. Many of them will speak in English. So there's definitely no reason for international listeners to kind of stay away from this conference, because most of the speeches will be in English. And especially considering the fact that you will be live streaming from the event and publishing all of this online. We see a value in having the majority of the speeches in English, including my own. I will also give my speech in English. And well, I can go through a few more. We have Fredrik Hagberg, who's chairman of the Swedish Identitarian Activist Movement Nordic Youth, and a quite popular international speaker. And this kind of YouTube, Instagram phenomenon, Alex Strongman, Alexander Syding, who's pretty interesting person. He's a very multi-talented person. He's an artist, engineering physicist, musician, programmer, so forth, and also bodybuilder and a good friend of The Golden One, which I know has been on your show before.
Sure. Yeah.
And hopefully we'll also have The Golden One.
He should definitely make it. Get your ass there, Marcus, if you're listening. We definitely want you there. So.
Yeah, he has promised that he will do his best to make it.
All right. And, sounds good.
I think it will, but. As we say on the Kickstarter page for the event, that I'm sure there will be some sort of link or something together with the notes for this show. The list is not finished, and more participants will be added as we go. And also, of course, Isaac Boman. I think he was on your show before. He's author.
No, he hasn't been on yet, actually, but we're going to try to get him on here soon with his new book release and everything.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, he's a very interesting fellow and author of the newly released book, Money Power. And an economist, writer, and lecturer, and has a broad background ranging from the banking sector, media, politics, and various NGOs. And his book is really important, and it covers a subject that has been kind of neglected in many of the recent works published within the alternative right. So I think it fills a void, and it's important to highlight.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's cool. So just give us a bit more info about the way that people can help out, make sure that the conference, comes into fruition. You guys have a Kickstarter, you have different kind of, levels, or I guess they call it pledges or something there. But there's also, it's kind of done together with a book release, correct? I think some of the tickets or some of the pledges are included with the book, at least last time I checked in on it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have an upcoming book from the kind of grand old man of the Swedish New Right, Joakim Andersson, which is coming out in Swedish on Arctus in the next couple of months. And a small part of this Kickstarter campaign will go towards translating it into English as well, because it's a quite important book, and it's very much of interest for international readers as well. It's called, in English, the title is Rising from the Ruins, which also happens to be the title of our conference this year, which is, by the way, taking place on Saturday, February 25th. So it's less than 3 months away. We expect to sell out. Pretty much, we have set a limit of guests at 300, and we expect that all of those tickets will be sold out throughout the Kickstarter. So don't wait with buying your tickets in the hopes that you can get them later. I mean, make sure to get your tickets through our Kickstarter, because otherwise you might have a difficulty getting tickets later. And regarding this book, it's basically a very well-needed overview of the alternative right, so to speak, in a very broad sense. It contains a foreword by myself, and the first chapter is about the end of the 20th century and the liberal order, which basically means that now, even though it's 2016, we can finally see the end of the 20th century. I mean, it's right. 16 years overdue, but I mean, in terms of politics and culture, this is definitely the end of the 20th century and the liberal order.
In terms of 1,000-year cycles or millenniums, it's not too bad, you know. And it can't, the change and the shift can't come soon enough, if you ask me.
I totally agree. And this chapter deals with a historical background to the present crisis. With a theoretical basis in Spengler, Turchin, Brooks, Adams, and several others. The liberal order is about to end, and something new is direly needed. Mere reforms are neither possible nor desirable. This crisis is systemic. Then we have chapter two, the demise of the toothless so-called right, which contains a shorter analysis of the, well, what was the establishment right during the 20th century, which is basically the liberal right, and their various failures and how they failed to kind of resist the leftist advancements during 68 and after that. The third chapter is about the new left. It's called The New Left, A Failed Attempt, which contains a shorter analysis of the promising critique of liberal civilization that the new left initially kind of provided, but what was ultimately replaced with political correctness and utter stupidity. And the fourth chapter is a kind of in-depth analysis of the new right, which is called The New Right, The Fundaments. The anti-liberal perspective, metapolitics, grass, and so forth. And the new right has inspired most of the challengers of the liberal order. And in this chapter, we take a closer look on the worldview and the vocabulary of this essential milieu. I will just highlight a few of the chapters I view most relevant and most interesting, because there are quite a lot of them. We have chapter six, which deals exclusively with the identitarian movement, and the factors behind their success and their relationship with the worldview of the new right. We also have a chapter on Castle Pound. We have a chapter on the neo-reactionaries, about the degeneration of libertarianism and the neo-reactionary movement as a necessary reaction to this. And also, we have a chapter on Rodrigo Duterte as a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
It deals with a new world order where rightist and nationalist leaders are on the rise from India and Thailand to Poland and Hungary. We also have a chapter about owning the streets and the importance of public space and attempts to conquer it, from EDL to Pegida. Of course, we also have a pretty long chapter which is exclusively dedicated to the alternative right and focusing on factors behind its success. There's a chapter about Dugin, and of course, there is a chapter about Trump, to read the description, the God Emperor viewed from a perspective mixing Spengler and St. Francis. And the final chapter is called The New Century, a short summary attempting to identify the many, many factors of success and reasons for optimism described in the previous chapters. So that, there you have it. There you have a brief summary of this book, which hopefully will make the listeners eager to support it on the English edition.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds very interesting. Let's talk about what else we should squeeze in here in the first segment, Donnelly, before we wrap things up. For the first segment, I mean, we have more coming up, of course. We have more room to discuss, you know, these ideas and some other things I want to discuss with you. But there's more books, of course, that you guys have coming out all the time. You keep, pumping them out. What else should we know about upcoming?
Yeah, I mean, we basically release four new books per month at our current pace. And the two more most important books of the past month that I really want to highlight is is the two books were recently published by the French New Right author Guillaume Fay. Was previously considered the Crown Prince of Grasse before he had this falling out with Alain de Benoist due to Fay being a little bit more radical than de Benoist in Grasse itself. And those two titles are Understanding Islam, which is the first book that I've read that is actually an in-depth critique of Islam from not from a liberal perspective, but from a ethno-nationalist kind of civilizational perspective, rather than these kind of tired arguments about Islam being a threat to our liberal values and to our gay pride marches and so forth. It's a very, very nice book, a very well needed book, because Islam is worthy of criticism, but should be criticized for the right reasons and not for threatening equality or HBTQ or something like that, due to the threat it poses to our entire European civilization. And the second book I want to highlight, and this is probably my favorite of the two five books we recently published, it's Archaeofuturism 2.0, which is a follow-up to the best-selling previous book by him, Archaeofuturism, which many listeners might already be familiar with. The main difference is that this book is purely fictional. It kind of presents his worldview, his ideology in a collection of cohesive short stories that forms a longer story that spans several thousands of years. So you could say it's political science fiction, and it's very well written. It's really a really enjoyable read, and it's a very, very good beginner's book, because I mean, it's easier to transfer ideas in the form of fiction than in the form of kind of dry ideological works. So this is a book that might be quite successful with a bigger audience, I guess.
So the title for that is Archaeofuturism 2.0. Is that the title for the book?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. I will provide you with links so you can attach them to the notes for this program.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely do that. So we have a couple of titles then to look out for, folks. Rising from the Ruins, Archaeofuturism 2.0. We're also going to add a link to check out the Daily Beast article there too. Kind of interesting, the room that they gave for this topic. Very interesting for being the Daily Beast, to be honest. And then, of course, to the Kickstarter itself, Identitarian Ideas. If you guys want to help out and support, make sure that we all can make it there and that this happens. You know, get your tickets through the Kickstarter. We'll have a link up to that. And also make sure to give us the other links here, Daniel, at the end of the first segment. Arctos, Ride On, etc., whatever else you want to plug here.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, Arctos.com, RightOn.net. Those are basically the most important websites to visit. And from there, you can access pretty much everything else.
All right, very good. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to continue in the second segment with Daniel Friedberg, the Members Hour. Definitely stay tuned for that. Much more to discuss, much more about some of these ideas, of course, and how to continue the success, the growth, and what direction we should go. There's a lot of angles to discuss there. So stay tuned. RedEyesMembers.com is the website for the second segment. We'll be right back.